Hi, everybody. Let me start by thanking the organizers, of course, for the opportunity to speak here and also for putting together this very nice and stimulating meeting. What I'm going to present here is a relatively simple cosmological model of a homogeneous universe with certain matter components, which you can quantize in the standard kind of canonical Wheeler-DeWitt sense. And you can choose one of the degrees of freedom in your system as a kind of relational clock. But there are various choices you can make. And what you find in this model, in a way that I will explain, is that the theories resulting from different choices of clocks are quite different. And they are completely inequivalent. They make very different predictions if you take this model seriously. So this is work done in collaboration with Lucia Menendez-Pidal, who was originally also supposed to speak after me and unfortunately cannot be here. But if I have time in the last 2 minutes or so, I will also mention a bit more the things that she was going to present, which is more the detailed technical results. The first part was more meant to be a conceptual overview of what we're doing. So this is, if you want, an illustration of the problem of time in this particular cosmological setting. So here, the first slide was meant to introduce the concept of relational clocks, starting from the classical theory. Of course, we have seen this now in many other talks, including the ones earlier in the same session. So I can probably be a bit brief here. But just to remind you that here I've just started with this question posed by Carlo Rovelli in 91, what is observable in classical and quantum gravity? Of course, we have diffeomorphism symmetry in GR, and so coordinates are just arbitrary labels of space-time points, and they don't actually have a physical significance in themselves, right? And so if I want to define observables, I cannot do something like just saying the Ricci scalar should be evaluated at a point x0 identified by some coordinates, because that has no physical significance. So here I'm mostly just interested in clocks, of course, also in the spirit of this conference. So there you can ask a question, for example, in cosmology, if you want a more practical question, what was the spatial curvature of the universe at t=0, right? So that would be a question you could ask. And again, this really doesn't have any physical meaning without further specification. From this canonical point of view that I want to advocate here, you can say that there's a Hamiltonian for general relativity, which generates gauge transformations. And so normally we would think of observables as being gauge invariant, so then they have to commute with the Hamiltonian, but then they're actually constants of motion, a point made by Unruh and Wald, for example. And so it would seem that these are extremely restricted. And of course, in general, you want to see dynamics. We don't just want to see that are things that are constant in time. So the way out, of course, as suggested by others here in this meeting, is to use material reference systems. We want to label space-time points, not by some arbitrary coordinates, but by the values taken by reference matter fields. Often these are scalar fields. And then you can ask a question like, what was the matter energy density when the scalar field took a particular value? And ideally, if this is a nice, well-behaved monotonic clock, then that would single out one instant of time, and then that would be well-defined. So that's the philosophy we're also following here. So here's the model. So it's a homogeneous, isotropic, spatially flat universe, which is kind of the simplest non-trivial universe you can think of. So A of tau is the scale factor here, which corresponds to the expansion or contraction of the universe. Tau is your arbitrary time coordinate, which is here left free. And N of tau is the choice of Laplace function, which is basically arbitrary in the sense that a choice of Laplace function would correspond to a particular choice of time coordinate, right? So by specifying N, I could specify what kind of time coordinate I'm working in, but this is really a free choice. And H is a flat metric written in your favorite coordinate system. So that's the geometry. For the matter, we have two components. So one is a free massless scalar field. People who know about quantum cosmology are very used to this. This is one of the most popular relational clocks, of course. So again, this just depends on tau. And then you have a perfect fluid, which is your second component. And this is characterized by an energy density, which is called rho. It's also characterized by an equation of state parameter W. So that's something that comes from cosmology. And that's basically just a specification of the type of perfect fluid you are interested in. So for example, you could take this to be a dust-like matter, which would be W=0. Perhaps the nicest interpretation is W=-1, in which case this models dark energy, which is of course the currently dominant component in the actual observed universe, but you could take this to be an arbitrary number. The formalism will not be sensitive to that in what follows. And then the point is that there's a conserved quantity associated to this perfect fluid, which is this M here, which results from taking the energy density and multiplying it with an appropriate power of the scale factor, which of course depends on W, because different types of matter have different time dependence. But this M is going to be a constant of motion. You can think of it as a conserved momentum, or in fact, energy is might be a good way of thinking of it. So then you derive the Hamiltonian for the system, and then you can change variables. You can do a canonical transformation to bring it into this simple form. So this is a simple form that you can obtain for any of these perfect fluids. You have three canonical pairs, which I'm just going to explain now. So the first is a variable V with its conjugate momentum pi V, where V is a power of the scale factor, where this power, of course, again, depends on W. So it depends on the type of matter you have chosen here. So for example, if you wanted to use dark energy, which is perhaps our favorite interpretation, then W is minus one. You see V would be proportional to A cubed. In this proportional sign, I'm just ignoring numerical factors, which are not of interest for this talk. So V would then be proportional to A cubed. So it would be something like the volume. So that's why it's called V in this case. But just to remind you that if this perfect fluid is different, then it would be a different power. Here for the scalar field and for the perfect fluid, I have just taken the scalar itself, and I've taken this conserved quantity M and just absorbed again some numerical factors for simplicity, which you are free to ignore. So this phi still represents the scalar field, and this lambda now represents the conserved quantity for the perfect fluid. There's a pi phi conjugate to phi, and there's T, which is conjugate to lambda. And I've absorbed some factors here into the Laplace function, again, for simplicity. So this is a very simple constraint, right? It has this minus sign here in front of the geometry part, which I think was emphasized in particular by Klaus Kiefer, which is generic for these kind of models. It's quadratic in the momenta pi v and pi phi, but it's only linear in the momentum lambda, which comes from the properties of these perfect fluids. And then T is this funny variable, which also represents the perfect fluid. So why is it called T? Well, there's a particularly simple gauge in which I set this n tilde equal to one. And so in that gauge, this constraint really just is of the form some stuff plus lambda, right? And so this lambda then really plays the role of energy of the other stuff. And indeed, the equation of motion is dt by d tau equals one. So in that gauge, T is just time. But that's, of course, just a particular gauge. But T is certainly a good candidate for a relational clock, quite an obvious one, but there are others. So that's the point. So here, classically, the variables T and phi always evolve monotonically. You exclude this degenerate case here. These are always good relational clocks. So these are two of the clocks we want to use. V, the volume, of course, this is related to the expansion or the contraction of the universe, which you then need to be monotonic, right, for this to be a good clock. So there is one case in which it's not globally monotonic, which is if lambda is negative. So for example, if you have a negative cosmological constant or a negative energy density in this dark energy, then the universe would recollapse at some maximal volume. And of course, then your clock would start going backwards. Here you see the classical solutions V of T and phi of T. So here I'm just using T as a clock to parameterize the volume and the scalar field. What I want you to take away is basically just two things. So the first thing is what you see on the left here is that all solutions have a singularity, which is V equals zero. In fact, for example, if you follow this solid line here, this would be the contracting branch of the universe, which ends in the Big Crunch. Here, the solution is not defined. And here you would have the Big Bang, which is, of course, then the expanding universe. So these two are just time reverse related, of course. And the same would happen here for this case where lambda is zero, and for lambda negative, you would come out of the Big Bang and you would end in the Big Crunch within one cycle. The point is that these are singularities. These are, of course, the Big Bang and Big Crunch singularities in the classical theory that we might want to avoid in the quantum theory. And at these singularities, this is a very important point, the scalar field actually diverges, right? You see, whenever there's a singularity in V, the scalar field goes to infinity, which is, of course, what you expect. This is why it's a singularity. The matter field diverges. So now if you use the scalar field as a clock, something very funny happens, right? Because as you approach the singularity, your clock runs away to infinity. So indeed, if you now plot the exact same solutions as functions of phi, you have V of phi and T of phi, then your singularities are now out at infinity. They're here at plus infinity and minus infinity. Conversely, there is the opposite behavior, which is very funny, which happens when lambda is positive, right? So when, for example, you have a positive cosmological constant or you have a positive energy density in any of these perfect fluids, which is that the scalar field actually settles down to a constant asymptotically, right? So the universe expands and the scalar field just goes to a constant. And so if that's the clock, well, it means the clock seems to kind of stop asymptotically. It slows down and asymptotically stops. So the volume actually diverges now at some finite time seen by this clock, which is peculiar. So we are, of course, used to that in GR. These are just funny coordinates in some sense. But the point is that the explicit form of these solutions really highly depends on the choice of clock. This is now very important when we quantize. So these classical solutions, they terminate at some finite time as measured by a clock. And this is something we are used to. These are the things I said before. So in T time, this is the Big Bang, Big Crunch singularity that we know. In phi time, well, the universe expands, but the clock settles down to a finite value. So it seems to happen at a finite time. So classically, of course, that's fine. The solution just terminates there. Either it goes to V equals zero, or it goes to V equals infinity. And the solution is not defined beyond that. But quantum mechanically, of course, if we require a unitary time evolution, which is what we're doing in this work, then of course the state cannot just disappear. By definition, it has to continue beyond these points where classically the solution would terminate. And so this is a point that, you know, if you look at it from that perspective, seems quite obvious, but really has some quite deep implications if you then look at these different clocks in the quantum theory. There's a conjecture here that we're building on, which is Gauthier and Desmarais in the 1980s. And they say that unitary slow time quantum dynamics is always non-singular, but unitary fast time quantum dynamics inevitably leads to collapse. So what they mean by a slow clock or slow time is a clock that only measures a finite amount of time to the until it hits the singularity. So here it would be this T clock, right? So the singularity is at a finite time seen by this clock. But this phi clock runs away to infinity. So it's a very, very fast clock, right? It ticks kind of infinitely fast as you approach the singularity. And in that, for that clock, the singularity is at infinity. And what they're saying is that if the dynamics is unitary, well, this T case, you need to have a correction to the classical behavior. You cannot just terminate your solution at some finite time, but you actually have to resolve the singularity. And that's what we confirm. And of course, we extend it to this other case where the universe would reach, you know, infinite volume at some finite time, which again is not allowed in the quantum theory. The details, they depend on additional choices, which I don't really have time to discuss. Of course, you have to choose an operator ordering in this business. You have to choose an inner product. Technically, what we're doing is a reduced quantization. So we are specifying a clock variable before quantization. We are defining relational Dirac observables with respect to this clock, which then become kind of standard time-dependent expectation values. So you might prefer something like a Dirac quantization, which was mentioned in other talks. We have some strong indications that at least for the case of the T and phi clock, this would lead to completely identical results. You can then, in these cases, you can still split the system into a clock part and the rest, and you can actually go through this Dirac quantization. But this is pretty much still work in progress. The punchline is still that if you impose unitarity, then quantum solutions have to continue when classical solutions terminate. What that means is for the T clock, you resolve the singularity, but nothing else. If phi is the clock, the universe must recollapse at some finite volume rather than going to infinite volume, but there's no singularity resolution. And if V is the clock, which is the third case, then unitarity is in some sense trivial. So both V equals zero and V equals infinity are just the boundary values of your clock, and you don't need to correct that in the quantum theory. And so you can follow the classical solution exactly. Here's just a very quick summary relation to previous work. So what got us started on this was a few papers by Grip and Thibault. So they looked at this model just in the T time. So in this kind of Schrödinger-like quantum theory, they did find this generic singularity resolution, which was very intriguing to us. So we wanted to understand that better. We kind of extended that work to some extent by comparing now with these other clocks. Bojewald and Halonen also found this inequivalence that we are finding with very different methods using deparameterization and an effective approach. And the phi clock, in some sense, was studied by Pavlovsky and Ashtika in the context where lambda is just seen, little lambda is just seen as a big lambda. So it's seen as a positive cosmological constant. And they find this recollapse at large volume, which is equivalent to what we are finding. So that was all I wanted to say. If I can take two more minutes, I'll just briefly show some of Luthia's stuff. Is that okay? Seems to be fine.
Yes, good. Sure.
Right, okay, so here's just the form of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, just for concreteness. I showed you this classical constraint before. This is the quantum version of it. Just to make clear that for all these theories that use different clocks, we always use the same form of the constraint. So there's no changes in operator ordering or things like that between these different theories. And here you can see quite explicitly that you could think of this as an evolution equation in T, but also in one of these two variables. And so this again shows you that sort of each of these three variables can play the role of a clock. And you can solve this exactly to get the explicit solutions in terms of Bessel functions, which is very nice. And of course, very helpful in going further. To show a bit more what happens, so we fix an inner product, which is adapted to the nature of the problem. So for these kind of second order equations here with respect to phi of v, this is a Klein-Gordon type inner product. For t, it's a Schrodinger type inner product. So if you do this for v, unitarity is automatically satisfied. No boundary condition has to hold. If you choose this Schrodinger time, you get a boundary condition at zero, which comes from the fact that the classical solutions will terminate. The quantum solutions are reflected from v equals zero to preserve unitarity. For phi, the opposite happens. You're now reflected from v equals infinity to preserve unitarity. And maybe the last thing I want to show is these kind of plots here. So that just shows expectation values for these states. And you see kind of quite clearly these solid lines are the classical solution and the quantum solution. These are different choices of state. And of course, the expectation values, given that the state here is reflected, they don't follow this classical solution near the singularity, but they are actually kind of staying at some finite minimum, which depends on the state. So this minimum here depends on the parameters of the state. Similarly here, for the evolution in phi time, you cannot follow this classical trajectory to infinity. You kind of have to be reflected, and therefore there's now a finite maximum. So here are the conclusions. There are these three different quantizations, and they differ in these kind of quite essential ways, whether there's a boundary condition at a certain value of V, whether there's singularity resolution, and whether there's a maximum volume that the universe has. General covariance seems to be lost in this kind of naive sense that sort of these theories are clearly different. And you can really guess the behavior of the clocks by applying this kind of slow clock, fast clock criteria. I should stop here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Stefan. There are actually questions. The first one to raise his hand was, I think, Abhay Ashtekar. Do you want to ask your question?
Right. I mean, in the work that we had done, the first statement is that in loop quantum cosmology, with a phi clock, the singularity was resolved. Mm-hmm. But in Wheeler-DeWitt theory, it is not. I think you're talking here about the Wheeler-DeWitt theory. But even with the phi clock, there are very subtle issues about self-adjoint extensions. The operators were not essentially self-adjoint. Did you find the same thing in your Wheeler-DeWitt? I mean, not phi clock, but t clock and d clock. For the phi clock, I know in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation also the operator is not essentially self-adjoint.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Yeah, so that's something I didn't really want to go into here because the time is very limited. But yes, the answer, short answer is yes, we found exactly the same issues. There's no unique self-adjoint extension. There's a free parameter, which then becomes a choice of free function that you have to choose to define a self-adjoint operator on a subspace of the initial Hilbert space and so on. And the only difference to your work, which indeed only covers the Wheeler-DeWitt theory, of course, is that lambda in our case is not a fixed parameter, but it's an integration constant. So, you know, you have to take superpositions of all possible values of lambda. So in a sense, this gives you an extra dimension in your superspace. But of course, you can analyze the problem separately for each value of lambda, and it's identical to your work. And indeed, for the T-clock, you have to ask the same questions. And indeed, there's a choice of self-adjoint extensions, which is not unique and is a choice.
And the conclusion is the same for every choice of self-adjoint extension.
We don't have a strong result like that. We certainly checked different choices and there didn't seem to be any, you know, significant differences. I think your results are the strongest that I'm aware of in terms of the you know, not having a strong dependence on the choice of self-adjoint extension.
Right. Thank you.
Philip, go first. I am happy to, I'm more curious to listen to Philip.
Okay, in that case, Philip, please ask your question.
Well, I think maybe my question was partially answered by the previous answer, but so yeah, I was a bit surprised that here you said that, I mean, you're saying you're doing a reduced quantization, and then I think you said that T and phi quantization are equivalent to Dirac quantization, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was a bit surprised that then you get these physically completely different properties in these two different reduced theories, despite the fact that they're this should be unitarily equivalent if mm-hmm. If they correspond to the same perspective neutral theory, really. But then I guess that probably has something to do maybe with what you answered to Abai's question, that maybe you're dealing with non-unique observables or non-unique self-adjoint extensions. Does it have anything to do with that?
Thank you for the question. It's a very important point that, again, I didn't really have time to explain well. So there might be a dependence on the self-adjoint extension. I don't know the answer to that, but I think there's a more fundamental issue here, which you can see already at the classical level. So if you go back to this form of the constraint, right? So the point is that basically the splitting of clock and system Hamiltonian does not happen for the same form of the Hamiltonian. You have to choose different Laplace functions technically, right? So here, you know, if you have n tilde equal to one, you see this is clearly the clock Hamiltonian, which is kind of trivial, and you have some other stuff. Now, if you want to do this for phi, of course, this is not going to work. If I choose n tilde equal to one, I have to choose n tilde equal to v squared, right? If I do that, then this guy would be the clock Hamiltonian and the others will be the system. So the correct statement, I think, is that, you know, there exists an equivalent direct quantization for both cases, but it's not the same, right? Because you have to choose different expressions for the constraint. And of course, these may also be inequivalent to each other from the perspective of the direct quantization. So that explains on the technical level this result, but of course what it means philosophically or conceptually is another question, because of course classically you can choose any Laplace function, but that's what happens.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, Carlo, you have one more question. Could you keep it?
Yeah, this time it seems to me that where this is pointing, I mean, this is of course technically good, and this is pointing is why do we ask unitarity in one of these clock variables? This is just what I don't guess. Why don't we go in the direction that Philip was saying? So we take a perspective neutral. I mean, why are we all fixed in finding a time variable when the theory is predictive without, generative is predictive without having to pick up a variable? If we say, let's work with this time variable, and then we force the theory into unitarity in this variable, we do get contradictions, but that's because we impose a unitarity beyond what is required by consistencies of probabilities.
Right, yeah, no, that's a good point. Of course, here we are making this, if you want, very conservative assumption that the standard formalism of quantum mechanics is taken over and unitarity is assumed. And of course, if that's not the case, then the strong conclusion that, you know, you have to reflect the state and this kind of stuff is not necessarily.
That's very good, but it's a sort of a reduction ad absurdum of the of one specific idea, which is that it should be unitarity in all clock times, which is wrong.
I think these conclusions will hold even in absence of unitaric assumption. I think that, you know, you can do the path integral version and these conclusions will hold. And it really has to do with the inequality form, the constraints that. That's what I just explained last by Stefan just a minute ago. So I don't think it is. I mean, I agree with you, but I don't think unitarity or not unitarity is the heart of the question. It really is what is your constraint, and it's a funny thing, but because even in the path integral, you will have to use, you know, effectively one constraint or the other, if you like. I mean, whatever you are integrating over.
We haven't looked at this. This is one of the obvious things we would like to understand, the relation to path integral quantization. This is, of course, very, very canonical here.
But the different things, the transition amplitudes can be defined without saying which one is my time variable. Then, of course, I mean, there's nothing wrong in choosing a time variable and working with it. Of course, it works very well. But sometimes it doesn't work. And the fact that sometimes it doesn't work, it seems to me not a reason of worry, it's a reason for not doing it.
But I guess here, still in this case, your transition amplitudes, at least canonically, will depend on what your constraint is, no? So what sort of laps you choose classically and then quantize, because that's here the issue, it seems, why you get inequality.
Yeah, but you don't want to, but yeah, but there's a choice of laps here, which, let me put it in this way, diverges at the singularity, so to say.
Well, your constraint operator that you would use in your projection or the extraction operator, these projection and extraction operators are different in the two cases.
Yeah.
And I think that you can ask the question exactly what you said, Carlo. I agree with you. You can ask, is there a trend? What is the amplitude for transition from one side of the singularity to the other side of the singularity? Right? By mm-hmm. singularity being mm-hmm. defined to be the yeah. volume and the trajectory. And then we can ask this question. I think the answers will be similar. So I think it's just that there are inequivalent theories.
Well, that's Stefan, could you control that? Is that because yeah. you insisted a lot about unitarity here? So it's.
He did. But I think you one has to formulate in a path integral way. I'm agreeing that the way it is presented, what you said is, I agree with everything you said. But I think that you can go beyond that and talk about just transition amplitudes. But there really are, I think, mostly.
Okay.
I mean, we have done it.
Sorry. Yeah. To interrupt this yeah, discussion, yeah. I would actually like to listen to it more, but we have to keep to the schedule a bit.